Well, good morning. My name is Travis. I'm one of the four pastors here at Summit View. And like Tim just said, we have a new series called Plentiful that we are starting. And today we're going to have part one of five. We're going to do 5 weeks of this. And that's leading us into the fall. Because we pastors really believe that God has placed on our hearts that we are to advance. Not just men, but women as well. Everybody, we're advancing. The kingdom advances. And if you didn't know this, we have a great commission that Jesus has given to all believers, and that is to go make disciples. And so we believe that when Jesus said the harvest is plentiful, he meant it. He did say that the workers are few, though. And so our goal for this fall is to have all of us understand that we are workers for this harvest, and hopefully to put practical tools in people's hands and the proper whys behind the motivation. So we're going to start that today. But I wanted to start with this because this was in the New York Times this week. And the New York Times, if you know that news outlet, it's a fairly liberal, secular, very secular news outlet. And they had this, where they ran this feature. And I think it captures our cultural moment that we're in. I'm going to try to make the case for today. Who will stop the rain at some weddings? The answer is a shaman. Couples are spending six figures on destination weddings all over the world. And these are people, these are MBAs, these are Ivy League educated people, people with graduate degrees, tech executives, finance professionals. And they're paying for weather modification via rain dances. Rain witches, they call them rain movers. One bride, it says in the article, bought a rain-stopping ritual on Etsy. And there are resorts all around the world that are destination resorts for these weddings that are advertising weather shamans as standard amenity, right alongside spa services. And it's interesting because these are the same people who put these signs out in front of their yards. And notice the one in the middle there, science is real. And yet here they are paying for shamans. There was a poem written 158 years ago by Matthew Arnold. And it was called Dover Beach. And he was lamenting what he saw as a tide of faith going out, meaning it was receding as he saw people, less and less people coming to church. And he wrote, the sea of faith was once too at the full and round earth's shore. Lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar. 158 years ago, when over 58% of the population there in the UK still went to church, I wonder what he would write if he was alive now. Now that we've spent a lot of time in the Western world, Europe, America, probably Australia, being told that science and reason are enough. Technology will solve our problems. Education's going to answer our questions. And we don't need religion. In fact, religion is superstition, it's backwards, and sometimes maybe even downright evil, certainly worth being made fun of. But I think it's fascinating that the more that we've embraced that over the last century, two centuries, probably post-Enlightenment, the more spiritually desperate our culture has become. And so we see a secular culture buying shamans on Etsy, and I think it's because souls are starving for transcendence. Or maybe as the writer of Ecclesiastes said, God has placed eternity into man's heart, meaning there's something built into us where we know there's something more than just this. And so it's not just quirky wedding rituals. I think even the most public atheists today, there's been a shift among them in how they're thinking. For instance, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, She's arguably probably the most famous female atheist in the world. She's shared stages with the likes of Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, and advocates making fun of Christians. She's shared stages with Christopher Hitchens, who wrote God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. I read that book. That was an interesting book. Well, last year, she announced her conversion to Christianity. She was born in Somalia into a Muslim family. She escaped what was to be an arranged marriage. She wrote a book called Infidel that talked about her conversion out of that world, and she escaped into the UK. She became very educated. She wrote these books. She was sharing stages with, like I said, Richard Dawkins. She was very, very secular. She was one of those advocating make fun of Christianity in particular, or Islam as well. Religion poisons everything. We need reason. We need science. These are the things that will bring us human thriving. Well, what she says happened is she started descending into a place of brokenness where she just realized there was not a fullness or a wholeness in her soul. And she descended into alcohol, considered suicide many times. She was battling depression for years and anxious thoughts. And she was sitting with a secular counselor who told her, maybe you're spiritually bankrupt. And perhaps you should consider praying. And she said, well, I don't believe in God. And so her counselor prompted her and said, well, if you could believe in a God, what kind of God would you believe in? Describe the kind of God that maybe you could believe in. And as she described this theoretical, hypothetical God, the counselor eventually pointed out that she had just described Jesus Christ. And she wrote this. She said, atheism failed to answer a simple question. What is the meaning and purpose of life? And in an interview I listened to with her more recently, she said, we're not going to have the fruits of Christianity without the roots of Christianity. Without that story, those fruits will one day wither on the vine. Basically, what she said as she came out as a Christian last year is that atheism doesn't give you anything to live on. It doesn't give you a foundation. And so as we grapple with these hard things in the world and the chaos and the division and authoritarianism and just evils, she's realizing we need the fruits of Christianity in this world. And that was the first sort of intellectual ascent she had to Christianity. But then as she examined it further and she realized these are the only things that will bring us thriving as humans, she realized those things cannot exist on a materialistic foundation that excludes God. It had to include the reality of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Otherwise, it didn't have any foundation. And so I just want to make the case that if someone like her finds herself in this place of anxiety and depression, harassed and helpless in this world, and she turns to Christ, maybe, just maybe, the tide is turning. Do you remember when Jesus taught in parables when he was here? In Luke chapter 8, Matthew chapter 13, Mark chapter 4, the same parable is communicated. One of his first ones, he stood in front of the crowds and he said that there's this sower, a farmer, and he's got seeds, and he takes those seeds out and he just kind of indiscriminately spreads them to that audience who would have known farming. They would have said, no, you have to prepare fertile soil for the seed, and that's the only place you put it. And it seemed a little bit irrational, I think. But the implication there is that the sower, we're sowers, we're workers, should take the seed and spread it and trust that the seed will land in a good spot. We're supposed to spread it often. We're supposed to spread it far. And he has four different soil types that he describes the seeds falling on. One is a hard path that people walk on. And the seed can't take root. It just sits on the surface. And he said, birds come and they eat the seed and it just never does anything. The second soil is rocky. It's shallow. The seeds like start sprouting, but they immediately hit what he calls is persecution or just the sun coming out. They hit trials and it just doesn't go anywhere. The third soil, it takes root and it starts growing, but there's weeds in the soil and the weeds come up and they're the cares of this world and they choke out the plants. But there's the fourth soil type and it's fertile, it's soft, it's ready. And the seed falls into it, and the seed sprouts, and it grows, and it says it has fruit, 100-fold, 1,000-fold. It's fruit that can then feed the whole world and spread. Later on in the same passage in the Matthew account and the Mark account, he talks about a small seed, a tiny seed, and he says the kingdom of God, it's like this tiny little mustard seed, and you plant it, and it grows and it becomes the biggest tree in the garden and birds come and they perch on its branches. The soil is the human heart. Every single one of us is some type of soil. The seed is the word of God. It's the word of truth. It's the truth found in the scripture. Ultimately, it's the truth of the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. And when the soil is fertile and soft and the seed hits it, the seed inevitably grows. And you look at the little tiny seed and you don't really recognize, if you didn't know what it was, that this has so much power that this tiny little seed could grow into a tree that birds could perch on the branches of. But those are the things that Jesus taught. And so we believe as we go into this fall that we're seeing with stories like Ayan Hirsi Ali, that the cultural soil around us is moving from a soil like the hard path where the birds come and steal the seeds away to a soil that's maybe softer and more fertile and ready to grow. The Apostle Paul told his disciple, Timothy, be ready to preach the word in season and out of season. And I think as we consider a harvest and a season, sometimes the soil is harder, sometimes it's softer. We're supposed to spread the seed regardless. But it could be encouraging to us to understand that the soil may be softening. So here's our Bible passage for today. Matthew 9. When Jesus, he's going from town to town, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. I just referred to Ayan Hirsi Ali as harassed and helpless as she was going through anxiety and depression and finding her life meaningless. And I do think that this is the culture around us today, harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. We should share Jesus' heart and have compassion on them. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. So Jesus looks around and he's not seeing hostile skeptics. He's not seeing Richard Dawkins style atheists around him. Maybe there's a few of those, I don't know. He's not seeing super hardened opponents that he has to debate down. He sees these crowds of people who lack purpose and meaning. They're searching, they're desperate for hope, for fullness, they're broken. And I think that might sound a little bit like our culture today. As we look at our culture today, we have a meaning crisis in our world today. Teen suicide rates have doubled since 2008. They're just getting worse. I could go into a whole bunch of statistics if you really want to dive into some more recent statistics on sort of where teenagers are at and young adults are at in this world. Go back on our website and listen to part two of our technology series that we did last summer. But just some of the lowlights, I guess, not highlights. 63% of Gen Z report significant anxiety and depression linked to loneliness. Did you know that for those today under age 18, this was a Harvard study that I found, 80% say that they're consistently lonely. That's a lot. Only about, do you know, over age 65, only about 17% of people over age 65 say they're lonely. There's a huge, huge difference. And then lastly here, and these are just some of the statistics, 60% of Gen Z say they don't know their purpose. They don't know their purpose in life. They're living basically in the shallow end of culture, but their souls are craving depth. And they can't find it. I read a Buddhist psychologist. He said, we're in a meaning crisis. Science and reason are good for some things, but they won't tell you why you're here. And in a materialistic world that says science is everything, the human heart can't survive. It needs more than just facts. It needs a story that's big enough to live in. And I think our culture is starving for that, and the soil of the human heart may be softening. Kids, those of you in the room that are used to what we do here in the summers, we're still going to continue doing this week and I think next week, where you guys get a prize if you're able to pay attention and answer a question later in the sermon. You might just pay attention to the fact that the human heart is the soil. When I talk about the four soil types, the path, the rocky soil, the weeds, and the fertile soil, those are people. It's the human heart. What is the soil? It's the human heart. I've been following Justin Brierley. He's a journalist in the UK. He's spent nearly two decades on a radio show hosting conversations between atheists and Christians. He's had people like Richard Dawkins on his show. He's observed something more recently, that the atheism that was aggressively dominating the 2000s that we were immersed in, the atheists who promised science and reason would be enough, they've failed. And their message is softening. Even Richard Dawkins himself has admitted to the same thing Ayaan Hirsi Ali did, that the cultural foundation in the world that leads to the most human thriving is Christianity. And so when pressed, he admitted, yes, I'm basically a cultural Christian, though he denies the supernatural. But if secular thinkers are recognizing that God and God's stuff makes better sense of reality, I think we should start paying attention to maybe something shifting in our culture. And so back to the yard sign. In this house, we believe Black Lives Matter, women's rights are human rights, no human is illegal, science is real, love is love, kindness is everything. I mean, love is love. That one's sort of circular and a bit irrational. Science is real. No human is illegal. Women's rights are human rights. I mean, do you understand where some of these values, most of these values come from? Where do human rights come from? Genesis, the book of Genesis in the Bible, human beings created in the image of God. The reason we're valuable is because of that image that each one of us bears on our souls. No human is illegal. This is not relativism. These are creeds. This is religious. These are moral claims without a logical foundation. I was listening to a Freakonomics podcast just the other day, and it was about whales. I know it's kind of random. But they were talking about how there are people in the world today that still hunt whales. And the world's ethics have flipped over the last probably 60 to 80 years on whether or not hunting whales is right or wrong. And pretty much 100% of the world's population agree this is bad. We should save the whales. That PR campaign worked. But there are some communities that still hunt whales. And they're saying that they're doing it in a sustainable way. And in that Freakonomics podcast, which is a secular podcast, the broadcaster said, it's hard to know what's right or wrong in this because morality is subjective and there's no absolute standard. So we don't know whether it's right or wrong. Fascinating. But these are absolute statements. We believe human rights exist. We believe this. Where does that come from? So I've been reading Tom Holland. He wrote a book called Dominion. He's a secular historian. He's not a Christian, although he's maybe on the way to converting. This is Tom Holland, not the actor Tom Holland, Spider-Man. This is Tom Holland, the historian. And he said as he was studying, trying to figure out where right and wrong, virtue, morality, where's the foundation for this in history? He said, why are my values, my beliefs in equality, dignity, compassion, progress, freedom, why are they so different to the Greeks and the Romans? Where did they come from? So basically what struck him was how completely alien their values, meaning Greek and Roman values, and previous to that in the world, the pagan world, were their values. Where at the time of the Romans, 1 in 5 people were slaves. It was considered normal to own human beings and just to kill them if you wanted to, or to convert them into sex slaves or whatever. It was very normal to kill your babies. Abortions were rampant. And if your baby was a girl, because you couldn't tell before back then, we didn't have enough science to tell which gender it was. If the babies were a girl, they would literally take the living baby girl and put her on the dump pile in the garbage heap. They called it exposing. There's a letter from a Roman general back then writing back home to his wife and all these nice things about what's going on in the army and his life and wondering how she's doing because she's pregnant. And then this just casual statement at the bottom of the letter that says, if it's a girl, expose her. Meaning, leave her out to die. And do you know that the early church in the first few centuries dealing with Rome would go out to the garbage heaps and grab those little girls and take them home and raise them into a family and allow them to thrive and love them? It's a stark contrast. And so Tom Holland is studying this and realizing our modern values of equality and compassion and justice and love did not come from secular philosophy, did not come historically through anything other than Jesus Christ. I didn't get them from the Greeks and the Romans. I didn't get them from science or atheism. They went back to a person called Jesus of Nazareth, and now he has started going to church in the last 2 years. And his wife has converted. Things are changing. I think it's actually kind of wonderful today that even when people attack Christianity as being like unloving and unjust and abusive or judgmental, they're actually using Christian logic and morality and values to critique Christianity, without which they would have no foundation with which to do so. That was Ayaan Hirsi Ali's realization. Secular humanism, atheism, cannot provide the moral framework to judge what abuse is, what tyranny is, what injustice is. Only Christianity had successfully defended human dignity against those forces throughout history. So we have a world living on the fruits of Christianity. It's like in Jesus' parable, where the seed goes into the ground, the mustard seed, and grows into the tree, and the birds come and perch on its branches. Maybe these are the same birds that earlier in the same passage he's talking about that are snatching up the seeds off the path. And I kind of wondered that. He didn't say it exactly, but since it's in the same section, I wonder. Christianity grew into a big tree in the West. So much so that even the signs out front of people's houses that in some ways maybe are critiquing Christianity, they're like those birds perching on the branches of what has become a vast tree of influence, and that is Christian values spread throughout the West. And people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali are realizing that as atheists critique and condemn Christianity, there are those birds sitting on those branches, but they're sitting there sawing the branch off, not recognizing where its roots came from, the gospel. So I could have a whole bunch more research. I have a whole bunch of more statistics on where we could go and maybe prove my point a little bit more. But instead of going through all that, I'd like to invite my friend Mike up. Come on up, Mike. And we're just going to talk about something he's experienced recently with a friend. because I believe the soil is softening. Now, do we have that handheld microphone? Mike's going to need one. Yep, Chad's got it. Great. You can shout. Be great. All right, why don't you just pull your chair up just a little bit. You don't have to. We can pretend we're friends. Just kidding. Mike is my friend, and he's been a friend for quite a while now. I don't know.
The first time I saw you was on the stage of Fort Collins High School, probably in like 99.
Oh, man.
Playing the bass.
That was so long ago.
25 years?
Yeah. My first memory of Mike, I didn't know who he was, but we were live journaling back in the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Remember live journal?
Before.
This is like the original social media. This was even before MySpace.
MySpace, then Facebook.
Yeah. So you'd get on and it had a little thing where you could put your mood in for the day and what you're listening to music-wise, and then just whatever you wanted to post.
Yeah.
And this random stomach wapo, that was you, started talking to me. I was like, who is this guy? And then we met in person. And
how do they say, never before have so many said so much to so few?
Yeah, yeah.
Blogging.
So I actually went out and found, my live journal's still out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, none of all the quizzes we used to take where...
Yeah, like, I just want to go find it. It's like it is a journal.
Right? Yeah.
It's like those conversations.
Take this test and find out which Lord of the Rings character you are, and
yeah,
then you post
right,
it. And,
right.
Yeah, so we were doing all this way back in the day.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mike, I'd like for you to share... what we were talking about at your house over pizza.
Yeah.
Your story of your friend. Mm-hmm. But maybe before that, I was kind of wanting to set it up a little bit. The story you're going to tell, you've been friends with this guy since you were five, mm-hmm. right? Before we actually get into what happened, would you describe yourself as an evangelist?
No.
Are you the type of person who's always bringing up your faith and pushing that on people?
No.
No.
Not really, no.
Okay, yeah. So what
yeah.
happened?
So maybe one thing I want to acknowledge first is I can be a bit of a conversational bottle rocket. You sort of like light the fuse and stand back and off I go and we all hope nobody gets hurt, right?
Yeah.
So if you need to...
move on, yeah. Mike. That's okay. I've allocated some time for this. I think this is going to be helpful for everybody.
Yeah. I've been around quite a while. When I was younger, I definitely was involved in a handful of things, sort of trying out what evangelism might mean and how that might look. And that included stuff like doing cold turkey evangelism, like I know some of us have done, and trying to find ways to bring up conversations and sort of like, move people, convince people that there's, you know, trying to sort of make things work in people in a way that I think is only, these days, I only think is kind of for God to do.
Yeah.
And looking back at that, I guess maybe one other thing I want to acknowledge too is that it feels so ridiculous for me to be up here talking about evangelism at all. Like I know people in this room who are so much more faithful in prayer, in perseverance, in courage to share the gospel. I mean, it's 2 weeks ago I was here and we were sitting out there and I just listening to people and people in this room that I mean, it's just so absurd. Like, the thing that really makes it work for me, I think, is that the idea here is you're looking for someone who's just a normal person.
Yes.
I'm not an evangelist. This isn't what I'm, you know, and I am irrefutably mid at all of those things. So.
Which means you're the perfect person to talk about
exactly,
this because we probably.
Exactly.
That's probably the average of what's happening in here.
Yeah.
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 So why don't you tell us your story?
So my friend Noel...
Hold your mic up just a little closer to your mouth.
Sure.
There you go. Cool.
So my friend Noel, we met on like the third day of kindergarten, I think. And so that was 40 years ago in just a couple of months here. And we both just are like really curious people. And in... the last 40 years, we've drug each other through dozens, maybe hundreds of books about everything. He went to school for physics and math and engineering, quantum physics, cosmology, math, neurobiology, neurochemistry, philosophy, theology, all of we've read all those books of the atheists. And I don't think he would describe himself as an atheist. I think he was always kind of a little more intellectually honest there, that there's, he would describe himself as probably an agnostic over on the very far side of atheism.
Agnostic meaning you just, there's no way to know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. No one can know, we can't know. You know, hard atheism takes the same kind of faith as, you know, Christianity. It's a religion of its own.
Yeah, to declare that there is no God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he definitely gave me a run for my money. There was a lot of books, a lot of crazy conversations about a lot of things that were very, very challenging for my faith. And but what was really cool about it is that there was always connection. We always enjoyed just exploring the universe together. We still enjoy exploring the universe together. And I would walk away from those conversations about, you know, sometimes these scary books of God's not great, you know, how religion poisons everything. Like, what do you do with that?
I have it upstairs in my office if anybody wants to read it.
But I always walked away having connected with him about the universe in a way that was really cool, and I always really enjoyed it. And I would go away with a lot to think about and with a sense of, like, wonder and curiosity. And that's Noel. That's what I expect. About a year ago, maybe, we went out for a beer, and he asked me what being a Christian means to me, and I just told him that I've become convinced that this Jesus guy knew what was going on, and so I have decided to follow him. I'm going to let him be my teacher, I'm going to read what he says, and I'm going to go try to act like it's true. And he told me that he had become a Christian, and that he now considers himself a Christian. He had been through some really hard stuff, and in just sort of exploring what that meant for him, he had some experiences that really just convinced him that this all of the naturalism, the sort of commitment to the idea that there's nothing out there except what exists, that all had to go. It was all wrong, that it had all bottomed out, that there weren't answers there, it wasn't the truth, it was all a facade to sort of keep us all thinking in a way that keeps us away from the light and truth. It was stunning. It was, I sat here, I went home to my wife, Becky, and I was like, I don't even know what to do. It's like this piece of furniture that's been in a certain place in my life, in my head for my entire life, just moved. It's like, I never would have expected. And the way he described it was that, it's like he had shell within shell within shell of these things that he had built and these defenses and these things that he understood about himself and the sort of facade of who he was and what he was worth and why, and all of that had just been shattered and destroyed, and it was just in pieces all over the floor.
And what was it that shattered and destroyed it?
Well, what's really cool is he then said, but there's light and warmth shining through all of it, and it's just reflecting off all the pieces. He met Jesus. And everything he said at this meeting, I just wanted to, like, quote scripture at him, because he's, like, spouting truth, and he's not even, like, a Bible scholar, you know?
Yeah.
It was just incredible.
Wow. So what, you guys have been hanging out fairly regularly since you were five.
Yeah.
And you had just spent years discussing all of the hard things in life.
Yep. Yeah. We spent every other day at each other's house as kids, you know. I just never would have thought. I never would have expected to see him wake up like this. And now it's so interesting to, you know, talking with him. He feels exactly like you have about the tides changing. Things are shifting. Like,
yeah.
The whole facade of the radical atheism that I think we're still defensive about in a way that's maybe not healthy is just breaking down.
Yeah, that's one of the cases we want to make in this series, is we're probably reacting and responding to a previous culture.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our lack of putting ourselves out there is probably wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the things that's really standing out to him is just that love really is at the bottom of all of it, and that there's been so much sort of fear that's driven conversations about these things. Mm. And the truth that he's really connecting with really deeply right now is just love. Just perfect love drives out fear.
Yeah. So as you were talking with him for years, did you ever feel sort of a pressure in yourself, like, I need to bring up spiritual things, I need to bring up the gospel, I need to just share the gospel with him, I need to evangelize him?
Yeah, I'm going to be really honest and kind of vulnerable about that. I did feel that pressure sometimes, and one of the things I feel like I've learned over the last 20 or 30 years, which is not much, I know just this little piece of what evangelism might look like, and I am not an evangelist, and this feels like a little beachhead where I've had just a little bit of light and truth. Those times where I did try things like pushing God into a conversation or leaning on him about trying to share the gospel or anybody else, you know, cold turkey evangelism, those things were what the old church word is sanctimony, doing things for the appearance of holiness. That I think we would call that now virtue signaling or performative. The times where I felt pressured to do that, it was because I felt like I needed to be something or act like something that honestly kind of violated my conscience in a way. It felt icky.
Yeah.
And so honestly, I didn't a lot of the time with him. I resisted that and I worried about, you know, am I doing this wrong because I'm not forcing the issue somehow?
Yeah, yeah.
And instead I just connected with him and enjoyed that.
Okay. How do you think he would have reacted if he had sensed that he was a project?
Nobody's a project. Nobody needs your agenda, you know? And one of the things that I've talked with him about, it's funny that we brought up The Weight of Glory. Aaron mentioned that book. That's such a good book.
Last week's sermon.
Yeah, yeah, it's really just a sermon. It's only a chapter, but it's so good. But one of the things that I feel like I'm learning through this and looking back, I think I just sort of accidentally did. And one of the things that's really wonderful about this is looking back, I didn't do this. I mean, it's sort of like we talked about the sheep and the goats a few weeks ago, and I think it's funny that the sheep also go, wait, what? When? I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yep.
You know? There's a part in The Weight of Glory that C.S. Lewis talks about that you've never met a mere mortal, right? Everyone in front of you has a piece of the reflection of God in them. Every one of them is an eternal being that's either headed one way or the other. And he says that in Mere Christianity, he talks about that we all have these different machines to drive. We all have a certain amount of brokenness in us, right? And in the end, when the body of death falls off and we get back to the core thing, the thing that chose, if you could see the potential of the person sitting in front of you and how God made that person to reflect himself, you may be tempted to worship. We as a body are missing a piece of the reflection of God because that person in front of you needs help to see it, to fully realize it. What are the places I can look for in a person in front of me that I can see a piece of Christ in them? And just enjoy it. And that's it.
Yeah.
That perspective has just been, I think if I was going to talk about a piece of evangelism that I feel like I've come to understand a little bit, it's that little sliver of what we might call like relational evangelism.
Yeah.
And I think that's all there is to it. It's like one plants, one waters, but it's God who makes things grow. You're not doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's funny, I almost imagine like if it was my job to like bring the gospel to you or whatever, and I didn't do it, and you stand in front of God and you're like, what the heck? I never heard the gospel. How would I know? And God, can you imagine God be like, well, I told Mike to tell you and he didn't do it, so what am I supposed to do?
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's like if I don't speak, the rocks are gonna cry out. That's not the problem. It's I'm being invited into having a bit part in the story that God's writing with you.
Yeah.
You're not a project. I'm not here to like, you know, there's no condescension there. There's no, you know.
Yeah. So you didn't really see him as a project to fix.
No, if anything, he was just a delightful friend to get to interact with about the nature of everything. It's the curiosity and wonder are part of the things that drive me, and he's just been my sort of partner in crime in that for my whole life.
Yeah, yeah. I love that piece of the weight of glory. You've never met a mere mortal.
Yeah.
And yet we go about our daily lives just dismissing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the person at the checkout counter or the person in your living room, depending on your situation, that C.S. Lewis image of, there's an image of God in them that mm-hmm. if all the other stuff was stripped away, you'd be tempted to worship it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think just sort of recognizing that, it makes room for humility in me, that I'm not, this is not something I have to force or I have to do. I am being invited into being a part of that person's story because yeah. God put them in front of me.
Yeah.
But he's the one that makes them grow, not me. I don't, you know, that's not on me. I don't have to carry that as a burden that I've got to do this right or something, you know. It's that fear thing, like perfect love drives out fear, just love.
Yeah.
Find a thing to love in that you can relate to. And I know there's difficult things, you know, people are messy and there's boundaries you have to set and that those things are hard, but find the thing that reflects Christ in that person and blow on it and see what happens.
Yeah.
You know.
So really the secret for you in this was you spent time. You yeah. had margin to spend time and be faithful and be present. For and years, and love.
Yeah, and I just got to enjoy him. You know, it's not even like, it wasn't work.
Yeah.
Even. I just, there's things that I really enjoy about him, and I did.
Yeah.
It's almost a selfish endeavor kind of a thing, you know?
So a couple of things, as we were talking last week, we went out to lunch and talked about this a little bit. One thing I really appreciate about Mike, his humility, you know, he's sharing, hey, I'm not an evangelist, I'm not gifted at this.
Yeah.
This is an amazing moment that just happened in your life, and it's bolstered your faith. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, you talked about the seeds. I feel like, again, there's just this place for humility. Like, I here's this guy, it's like his face is still glowing from coming off the mountain because he just saw God, right?
Yeah.
And compared to him, I'm the seed in the thorns. I'm the one with the cares of the world. I'm the jaded one. I'm the one who's like seen too much. And I almost feel like I need to be careful not to communicate my like crustiness, like my dry old, my dry eyes and my old heart and my like, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I just
yeah.
want to be quiet and just listen.
Yeah.
That has really been really real, that there are facets of the Creator in the people around you that will be missing from the body if they can't come to life, if they don't take their place. So it's just been, I've been really encouraged. If you'd asked me 6 months ago if I knew anything about evangelism at all, I would have told you I don't know that I've ever seen fruit from any evangelistic endeavor in my whole life.
Yeah.
And I feel like that has shifted here a little bit, looking back on that and some other relationships where really all the places that I've seen that I think I've had an impact in my efforts to help grow the body and help disciple people around me, and that's like the some of the core of the Great Commission is making disciples,
yeah.
have all just been about enjoying what there is to enjoy about people and being humble and exploring things with them. And sometimes it's as simple as just remembering, you know, their kid had a surgery and how did it go? And, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, they know you're there. You care.
Yeah.
You're showing God's love to them.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's really easy when you just cultivate that in yourself. Like, go find people and like them. Like, find something to like and like them. All done.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jesus' heart in that Matthew 9 passage where he saw the crowds and had compassion on them.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out to do evangelism, you go out to make disciples, but you don't have that same heart, I think the word you used was performative.
Yeah.
Evangelism can become very performative, and people can feel like projects or like another notch on your belt.
Yeah.
And that is, that's not good.
Yeah, it's like within 5 minutes, it's like, oh, this isn't about me. You're trying to score points with your imaginary sky daddy. You just
yeah.
want a notch on your belt. I could be anybody.
Yeah.
You know, you
yeah.
don't care about me personally. You're just trying to score points.
Yeah.
I don't need that.
So as we go on in the series, we're going to try to have some practicals, so even some tools we can use. And the reality is there's different types of evangelism, and we outlined three that we're going to talk about, and this would be the middle one, mm-hmm. which is probably the one that is the most fruitful long-term and making disciples, and that is the one-on-one, relational, you're steady with someone, they're constantly in your living room, you're present with them. But there's also cold turkey evangelism, where you go out and you might knock on doors, you might share with someone on the street. We talked about that a little bit last week. And on one hand, you would say you have tried that and it hasn't been successful, but you're not opposed necessarily to it?
No, I would say, I mean, these are disciplines that we see the apostles doing in the Bible, right? And so the yeah. fact that I'm not connected to that somehow in the right way only tells me that he hasn't given me his heart about that yet.
Yeah.
And that's a defect in me. I don't, you know, and it may be that that's just never the, like, I may not be the mouth, I may not be the feet, right? And that's fine. We all have our place. I did know people, and I do know people who are very, very good at, like, they don't go to bed until they've shared the gospel with someone. They don't, yeah. I mean, it's, like, dangerous to be around them because you will end up in a gospel conversation with someone nearby, right? Like,
yeah.
I just wanted to order coffee. Can we just please, you know?
Yeah.
And those people have seen tremendous fruit, and their heart is for it, and they just love people, and they just can't. It's like out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I don't have that heart in the right way to do it, and I think there's many people in this room that do, and I'm so glad you're there. But I think one of the weaknesses that can be there is there's discipleship after that needs
yep.
to happen, and that's a very long-term process.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, you guys go out there on the front lines and bring them in, and I'll meet them, and I got the next 10 years, right?
Yeah, yep.
And we need that. We need everybody to be involved in this.
And that's another thing that I wanted to bring up. As we see the soil softening, and as I've been reading accounts and listening to people, it may be that as we go forward, at least here in America, the conversion experience, like us going out and evangelizing and making a convert, will be the easy part. Or maybe we'll just end up going to dinner with someone who's like, man, I just found Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but the Great Commission says make disciples, which means it's a long process. So that's just the first moment. Are you going to be faithfully walking with that person and helping them be a disciple 5 years from now? That's been my question about this moment for the church, and I think one of the things we want to highlight over the next 5 weeks. Discipleship really, really matters. And in fact, we're going to take on week 5, we're going to take a whole week and talk about, okay, what does this look like for the long term with a person rather than just that initial conversion moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we probably should wrap up because we're getting on time and we still
yep.
need to do communion here together.
yep.
So thank you for sharing.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
And if anybody else.
Okay.
I love talking about this. If you have questions or concerns or even want to just set me straight, like I want to learn from some of you about how this works.
So yes.
We'll be at the picnic and yeah, come talk to me.
Awesome.
Thanks,
Mike. All right. So before we move on, here's the question for the kids. Chad's going to have the microphone here. And today we have a Domino's game. And looks like a maze workbook. See, God is amazing, and a Dairy Queen gift card. So it's like jackpot. So does anybody remember? So the soil is softening. What is the soil? And this is for kids age 7 through 12. And if you've already had a prize, please don't put your hand up. I'm going to count to 3. And if you know what the soil is, put your hand up. 1, 2, 3. Got a Simpson right here. Yep.
My name's Luke. I'm 10, and the answer is the human heart.
Yes. Yes. The soil is the human heart. Congratulations. Enjoy your ice cream. I hope you like mazes. All right, band, if you guys want to come back up, we're going to transition. Because what all of this is about is what Jesus came to give us. And that in John chapter 10 says it's life. And Zeke started off this morning, I thought very appropriately, saying that his generation feels broken. And Jesus says, I've come that they may have life and have it to the fullest, whole. He says, there's a thief that comes to steal and to kill and destroy. And I think our culture is currently experiencing that. And they're starving, they're dying, they're broken, they're depressed, they're anxious, they're harassed and helpless, and they need a good shepherd. Jesus is that good shepherd. He had compassion as he saw the crowds. He saw the emptiness. He saw the brokenness. And he didn't just point the way to life like Richard Dawkins attempts to, saying, hey, just think deeper, have science, be reasonable, you'll find life. He actually claimed to be the life. In John chapter 14, he says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. And he didn't just offer ideas or arguments, he offered himself. He says, in me is life to the fullest. In me is pleasures forevermore at my right hand. In me is freedom. In me is connection to the ultimate source of hope and joy. And you can have it. And so how did he do that? He said, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The good news of the gospel is that while we were harassed and helpless, while we were empty, Jesus allowed himself to hang on a cross, dying, harassed, and helpless in our place, so that we could be found. The good shepherd went like a lamb to the slaughter. And he experienced the ultimate disconnection there, crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? He entered into the darkness that we humans feel where we're absent from the presence of God, so that we could have full access to the fullness and perfection of the Father and have that be an eternal connection. And so we're going to take the bread and we're going to take the cup, and the bread represents his body, the body of the good shepherd who became the sacrificial lamb, who died on that cross for us. And the wine, it represents his blood, which is poured out. Poured out so that we could be filled. It was emptied from him so that we could be filled with life. He took our place. He took our judgment. He took the punishment that we deserved because of our rebellion. He took the results of that rebellion, chaos, death, injustice, anxieties. And so our culture is crying out. They've tried to build life on science and reason, human ability alone, and they found that it crumbled. And I think that they're looking for something more. And we know that the answer is only found in Christ. So Anne Hirsi Ali, remember what she realized. We're not going to have the fruits of Christianity in this world without its roots. The roots meaning that God came to earth, became a man, lived a perfect life, died our death on the cross, entered our nothingness and emptiness and harassed and helpless state, and then defeated death and rose from the grave and offers us life eternally. So as we take communion together and close out the service, which I apologize, we went a little bit long. We had a lot of things to cover today. I want us to think about, what is my foundation? What am I building my life on? And is it such that when I go out to live my week, this week, and I meet people who are not mere mortals, is sowing a seed something that's in my mind? Because I've built my life on the only firm foundation. And I yearn and desire and long for those other people who are not mere mortals. to build their lives on the same thing, the foundation of Jesus Christ, the shepherd who laid down his life for the sheep. He's the one foundation that will not be shaken. We believe that the harvest is here, the soil is soft, and we have the bread of life to share for humanity to become whole and unbroken. So what we're going to do is we're going to divide the room down the middle here, and just for the remainder of the service, we're going to take this together, and we're going to sing together as we take it. And we're going to start in the front rows here, and as the room is divided, you exit out this side, and you come down and get the elements, and then return to your seat. In the process of that, pray, thank God. Thank him for what he has called you into, and that is life. He's offered a foundation. And we're going to sing, build my life, I will build my life. And there's a section in the song that talks about when we encounter others, we want to love them the same way that God loved us. If you're not a believer right now, we would ask that you would abstain from this. If you'd like to become a believer right now, all you have to do is say, God, I am a sinner. I recognize that my life has no foundation. I would like to thrive. And I just accept this free gift of what you've bought for me on the cross. And then feel free to come down. The secular writer Douglas Murray made an observation recently. He was referring to the seed of faith, or the sea of faith, the tide poem. He's lately called himself a Christian atheist. He's been an atheist. He's been friends with Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and shared stages with them. But he recently said, the thing about the sea of faith is it doesn't just go out. It could come back in again. That's the point of tides. And he won a debate against Richard Dawkins recently where he was arguing that religion should have a place in the 21st century, even though he's an atheist himself, which I think is showing that even non-believers are recognizing the value of the fruit of Christianity. What if the soil truly is softening? And what if we truly believe that the seed of the gospel is powerful? Let's sow seeds. Like the sower, let's just sow them to every human heart that God leads us to in his love. And if this truly is a moment when the tide comes back in, and we truly do see a revival in the West, historians are going to write about it. Now, I've heard tales of a somewhat revival from the 1970s, and stories of how maybe the church didn't quite show up the way it could have for the cultural moment post-1960s and hippies and drugs and free love and everything else. What if we have a similar yet more powerful moment right now? What will historians write about what the church in America does in response to the soil potentially softening? So remember these three things for this series. The soil is softening. The seed is powerful. Therefore, sow seeds. That's our vision for Summit View Church for fall 2025. And we're going to unpack practicals. We're going to unpack things. We're going to talk about different varieties of evangelism, different giftings. Everybody's an evangelist. I'm going to teach on that in 2 weeks. We're all called to this. We're going to have opportunities to go do cold turkey. Even if you're not gifted in it, it can be very good. We're going to talk about what Mike was talking about, where you're just faithful with a friend. And we're going to actually host some big events, sort of event-based evangelism this fall that we'd like everybody to participate in.